when I make a record like Mood Swings or Future Christmas, both of them, I'm trying to, I don't know that consciously doing this, but I'm, the records are made to appeal to everyone. It's not necessarily jazz fans.
When the world starts to get in your head, makes you stay in your bed, and then the big bad wolf huffs on
so
down your door.
So, in some ways, I mean, I think one thing a lot of trans people have in common is that we risk it all when we transition, and I certainly did. But at least for those few years, I had some consistency of income because I was working with Doc Severinsen. Now, since I've left Doc Severinsen, it's become quite a challenge.
This week's program features an interview with Jennifer Lightham, who is a career jazz and professional musician for over 40 years. She has played with Mel Torme, Peggy Lee, George Shearing, Woody Herman, Benny Carter, Doc Severinsen, and Katie Lang, to mention just a few. Jennifer is a transgender woman and transitioned in 2001 from being known as John Lightham. She's the subject of an award-winning documentary, I Stand Correct. It premiered and won the Best Film Award at the American Documentary Festival in April 2012. Her bass lines have graced many movies and TV shows. She is a bassist, vocalist, composer, arranger, lyricist, and producer. She is most proud of her career as a recording artist, and as now she has played on over 125 albums, including 10 albums of her own, including her huge hit, The Real Me, and the new release, Mood Swing. All your dreams can't be true. The ideal place for love's an arm is for you. It gets better. Jennifer Lightham Trio will be playing at Squash Grapes in Ventura November 19th. She can be reached at jenniferlightham.com. Here is an interview we did with Jennifer where she speaks about jazz, her music, and transitioning at the height of her career. It all comes true there, all's fair. Take a ride to Riverside. Welcome, Jennifer Lightham, to this edition of Groovy Tuesday and Your True Gender Radio. Can you start off by telling us about the jazz trio you will be bringing to the gig at Ventura on November 19th?
Well, my trio for Squash Grapes will be my regular drummer, who's been with me forever, and just a great player, Randy Drake. We played together in Bill Watrous's band for years and years and years, and still do. And my drummer, Randy, my pianist, is Andy Langham, and Andy is just one of the best musicians I know. He's a top call piano player here in L.A. He's playing with all kind of people, Michael Bublé and Terrence Blanchard and Poncho Sanchez. He's always on the road. Hard to get him, but fortunately for Squash Grapes, he's in town and he's going to play, and so we'll have my real band, the one that's on my records, and I'm very excited about that.
And you had a recent release called Mood Swings. I've been listening to that. I'm really excited about it. How did that come about?
I traveled with the Stan Kenton Alumni Band, and now it's called the Stan Kenton Legacy Orchestra. I'm a veteran of the big bands, and I played in Woody Herman's band and all kind of Doc Severinsen's band and lots of famous ones. So anyway, I get called to do that, and I go out and travel on the road with them. We had a tour scheduled a year ago last April. The tour was scheduled and canceled with a week's notice and left me with about almost a month of an open calendar and no income. And it was quite dire, really. And I was trying to figure out a way to turn my karma around right then. And I decided to just throw it out to the universe that I had a month open. I have some time. And I did a fundraising campaign on Indiegogo to make enough money to make three CDs. And we raised enough money to almost make two CDs. And I had to throw in a little bit of my own. But the first CD that came out of that fundraising campaign was Future Christmas. And that was released last year for the holiday season. And I'm very proud of that record. It was number one holiday record on CD Baby for a number of weeks, and it stayed up on the Crossover Jazz charts at number one for about 4 months. And then Mood Swings was released, small release, I should say, in the end of June, and it just went into wide release on October 21st in the past. But Mood Swings is getting so much attention. It's strictly independent record. It's not like I have a marketing company or a record company to promote, but Mood Swings is getting a lot of great attention, and it's been number one crossover jazz on CD Baby for over 3 months. Very proud. It's in tribute to my sister, Barbara. She passed away last March. And it was just as I was doing the post-production on Mood Swings when she passed away, and I had to interrupt it to go back and take care of her affairs. And when I got back to mixing, I took a few weeks off and I got back to it. I realized that the moods of the songs on the record were also extreme, that I decided that to change the order of the record to go from one extreme to the other. And then I added another song from a friend of mine, Jamie Finlay, to get a little bit of exuberance on the record. I thought felt it needed a little more of the... And the reason being is that my sister suffered from bipolar disorder. So I was trying to honor, emotionally at least, and in my art, I was trying to honor her life and what she dealt with. It's kind of like a bipolar jazz record. It really takes you from one extreme to the other with each song. The mood swings violently. But it's all good. I mean, it's not like it's a drag to listen. It's very deep and it's very emotional. Well, the concept for Future Christmas was that I wrote a song called Future Christmas, the Global Warming Winter Holiday Blues. And I was trying to come up with a holiday album that reflected not so much faith, but more family and just the general holiday that people celebrate during the winter solstice, you know, when the days are shortest and it's darkest out. And it seems there's there are many holidays around that time that have that theme in common, where they, as I say in Future Christmas, the Global Warming Winter Holiday Blues, I say it's time of year we chase out the dark. So I was looking for songs to record on that record that maybe weren't so much faith-based, but just based on the idea that it's a time of year of family, of warmth and love. And those kind of themes are year-round. Plus, I also gave it a little social consciousness, too, in that I think that global warming is probably the thing that is the most important crisis that the human race faces, that we need to get a handle on it. And in taking winter imagery and putting it in the lyrics of the Global Warming Winter Holiday Blues, I try to lightheartedly sound an alarm bell, basically. It's done, sometimes you get your points across more with sarcasm than you do with out-and-out anger, you know? Hopefully it gets a few people that might not think about it to get them to think about it, getting a handle on global warming and slowing it down at least.
But how does that play out live? What are the kind of reactions you think people have?
Well, we debuted that album at Catalina's last year in early December. This year we're doing the show on December 22nd at Catalina's in Hollywood. It was packed. I mean, people came out in droves and hey, we had an amazing response. It was wonderful. It certainly helped launch that record. And I usually do holiday shows every year during the month of December. And it's bounced around from place to place, but the it seems to have found a home at Catalina's. As I do with almost all of my performances, it sort of tells a story. And it has peaks and valleys, and it's a sort of a story arc to the set. I always try to program that way. I got that from Mel Torme and Doc Severinsen, and I always try to think of the sets as an entertainment as well as art music.
Big band is really popular now with a lot of the younger kids at the city colleges.
So music education programs, yes.
I understand you've done some music education programs.
Well, it's right now, and nowadays it's a little difficult, and I left my college teaching. I was teaching at Cal State Long Beach for about 4 years. I was the adjunct bass professor there. I fell in love with somebody back in New York and moved away for a couple of years and lived back. The love affair didn't work out, and I walked from my teaching gig, which professionally was maybe one of the dumbest moves I ever made. I really loved teaching at Cal State Long Beach. But I haven't been able to come up with a college adjunct thing ever since. It's a tough time out there. You know, whenever you have to put on your resume when you're applying for these places online, it asks you what your degree is. And I only have life experience. I've been a professional musician and working one for over 42 years, but I don't have a college degree. So usually the computer spits me out before I even get to the human resources person that would look at the application. So that's been really difficult to line up a college teaching gig. I teach privately. I have students that take lessons from me over Skype, and I have a few that come to my studio here in Pasadena. And in the past, I was quite an active teacher. I did a lot of clinic work for Boosium Hawks back in the 90s. And I've done clinics with artists and like Ed Shaughnessy and Bill Watrous, and have done, and of course with the Stan Kenton Legacy Orchestra, we do a lot of teaching. And so I've always been into doing clinics and teaching. I was artist in residence for a while at a high school in near Milwaukee, Wisconsin. But then I transitioned and they told me they didn't want their kids near that kind of thing.
Oh, God.
So, you know, I it's difficult being a transgender person and getting embraced by the education community, at least the jazz education community, so far. Except for that one little blip where Kelsey Long Beach asked me to teach there, I haven't had any luck procuring official type of teaching opportunities. It's really gratifying to see the private students that I've had do so well. There are many of them out there that are probably working more than I am right now.
I did see the film, I Stand Corrected. Really was touching and moving and inspiring. Let's talk about that briefly.
My public transition, whatever you want to call it, was in November of 2001. I had been living a double life for some time before that. That's basically the moment I made the big public splash. The movie played in a bunch of mostly LGBT film festivals in 2012. And overall, it won about 11 Best Film Awards, Audience Awards and Jury Awards. And very proud of that film. Unfortunately, the trans community really didn't embrace the film as much as I would have hoped. And I think the title may have had something to do with it. And when people see the film, they'll understand what that title means. It really doesn't have anything to do with the political correctness of the term for a surgery. It has more to do with the fact that before my transition, I sat on a stool when I played the bass because I was afraid if I stood up, I'd dance around. And I would dance around, and when I play music, I let myself go. And so I was worried I would be clocked if I were to dance around while I was playing my bass. So I sat on a stool for a long, long time. So after my, I had some complications with my surgery and required some pretty nasty stuff. I couldn't sit on a stool anymore when I played. It would have interfered with some of the stuff that was happening to my body. So I had to stand up. And in doing so, it was like a revelation. I could dance when I play. I could just let go. And so that's what I Stand Corrected really means. It's just a catchphrase. And I didn't really think about it at the time that it had anything to do with the name for the surgery. but unfortunately, I was hoping that trans people would have embraced the film more, I guess is my whole point. But the film does a really nice job of telling my story in a way that you don't focus solely on my gender. It's more about my whole life and the story arc of my life and the fact that I'm pretty good at something and had some fair amount of notoriety and went through this trial, and then what the effect of having gone through that trial has been on my professional life, as well as my personal life, but more my professional life. And I like the film in that it doesn't, the viewer, feel sorry for the subject. I really think we don't have enough trans films that celebrate trans individuals. It's more about the angst of the transition and the nastiness of the world towards us. I feel firm that I Stand Corrected did a really good service in trying to normalize the whole experience and humanize the subject.
In the film, Doc Severson saying he didn't care what gender, this was an extraordinary bass player. He backed you up.
Yeah, he was very supportive of me when I transitioned. I was very thankful for that. I don't know that I would have had the gumption to go ahead and because I knew it was going to be a very public transition. And I personally tried to keep it from becoming something salacious, you know, and I tried to stay out of the media as much as I could. This was 2001. It was a bit of a different time, you know, before GLAAD really was out there or anybody to be a watchdog for us.
And GLAAD stands for?
Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation.
Doing good work right now?
Yeah, they do good work. They haven't really embraced my media stuff. I've asked them for help a few times. I had articles that were being done in the New York Post about me. It's like the antithesis of what I would prefer my name to be associated with. And I asked GLAAD for help, and for some reason, they never jumped in. Anyway, that's another story. But yeah, I'm really proud that we made that movie. I had offers at the time from writers and people that wanted to tell my story, but I felt that having it in a documentary form would be the best way to tell the story, where we could back up everything we were saying. There's lots of footage of me playing with these great musicians and people, and there's lots of television that I was on and everything, and we were able to back up everything we said as far as any claims I made about my past.
Your identity is transgender. This kind of outing by fire into the public domain. Do you feel like the biggest transition for you was you coming out to yourself, or was that something relatively easy?
Everyone's story is so different. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, I always knew who I was, but what I projected was something else, because I was so afraid of losing my livelihood and losing the ability to make a living at the thing I love the most in life. I live to play music. Back when I was coming to prominence in the 70s and 80s, I didn't see many women playing jazz. You know, there were hardly any. And the ones that were out there were playing on more like stereotypically feminine instruments, you know. So to be a bass player at that time and be a woman was a very rare thing. And knowing what I know from having hung out in the boys club for so long of what male musicians say about gay people, even women, or I couldn't imagine the scrutiny I would have to come under for being public about my gender identity. So I hid it for a long time and was very conscious of that. And I think I got casually outed on a Halloween in Phoenix when I was working with Doc Severinsen. And all the people I worked with basically found out about me that night. And I found out that the consequences weren't as dire as I thought they would be, at least not in that crowd. And then Doc, you know, over time, you know, we talked, and he gave me the I don't know if courage is the right word, but just I realized that my career wasn't going to end, at least that particular gig wasn't going to end if I transitioned. And so I went ahead with it, knowing at that point that I had to make myself whole, that it wasn't going to work to continue as I was, living this lie and living in fear that I was going to be outed, you know, making a decent living at the time. But I got to the point where I didn't want to go on with living. The money didn't matter anymore. I didn't really care how much money I made. I knew my income was going to take a hit. But I felt that if I didn't transition, that I was going to lose my life, that this life would end. I couldn't live with the angst anymore. So in some ways, I mean, I think one thing a lot of trans people have in common is that we risk it all when we transition. And I certainly did. But at least for those few years, I had some consistency of income because I was working with Doc Severinsen. Now, since I've left Doc Severinsen, it's become quite a challenge to have enough opportunity to earn money playing music. It's something I've done all my life, and it's never been challenging as it is now. However, my outlook on life and my sense of well-being and my being at ease with people and being in front of an audience and perform and talk to them and that's never been better, you know. So it's sort of a trade-off. I worked really hard, and I still do, and I do every day, to try to normalize the whole idea of gender identity, that people don't have a fixed gender identity. At, you know, that's probably the wrong way to put it. That people should be allowed to express whatever gender identity that they feel they are. And slowly but surely, that's been happening. It's you know, obviously with all of the explosion of stuff in the media in the last year or so, it's becoming somewhat better. But then on another level, like this vote that just went down in Houston, we have a long way to go to educate people that we're not the King Kong monster. You know, that a lot of the... Oh, my computer just went blank. Okay, so that we're not the King Kong monster. Pause. That we're not what the media describes us as. I was getting my oil change the other day. I was sitting in a oil change shop. I won't give them the endorsement, but I was sitting in an oil change shop, and they had Jerry Springer's show on television in the waiting room. And it was like the most appalling thing I can... And what freaked me out the worst, I mean, this crap that was going on television was just horrible. My head was going to explode. But what freaked me out the worst was that I'm sitting in there with about 8 people in this waiting room, and they're all digging it. They're all watching it with like, and that's the education that people are getting about transgender people. It's the crap that's on television. And the vast majority of it has nothing to do with reality. And so we've got to get around that somehow. And it's hard to get a forum to be able to put people that can convince the non-believers of gender identity, that gender identity is something that's in your head and it's not between your legs. It's hard to convince those non-believers when we aren't given a decent forum. We have some actresses out there now and fashion models, you know, people like that are getting attention in the media. But it's for that. It's for the salaciousness. It's often not for the substance. When I make a record like Mood Swings or Future Christmas, both of them, I'm trying to, I don't know that consciously doing this, but the records are made to appeal to everyone. It's not necessarily jazz fans. I liken my music a lot to Vince Guaraldi's music, the great pianist that wrote the music for the Peanuts cartoons and wrote an incredible jazz record called Jazz Impressions of Black Orpheus, where he does so many great tunes, and Dave Brubeck's Take Five, and there's so many great artists that appeal to people across genres. And that's why I think my music gets labeled as crossover jazz on CD Baby is that it appeals to people of all genres, you know? And so, I don't know, getting people to come out to pay money to hear jazz is becoming more and more challenging. Most of what gets presented in jazz is from the people that are around the college age, where the nowadays is where a lot of the audience is in jazz education programs. And they basically more go out to hear their peers than go out to hear the experienced practitioners of it that have been doing it for their lifetimes. I'm hoping that changes. It seems like it's the other way around from when I was that age and just coming up. But we're starting to see more and more younger folks, you know, at our shows. And it's I don't want to sound like the voice of doom. It's hopefully it gets better and people of all genres become a little more interested in jazz. And you know, most people think of jazz, they think of Louis Armstrong or they think of Kenny G. And those are like the two most popular cats out there and under the form. And my goodness, there's a plethora of different styles between the two of those people.
But jazz seems to be born in the small club. That's where it is. And I think it's an economic thing as well as, can small clubs even be viable?
That's a great point, yeah.
And you're going to be at Squash Grapes, which is an intimate, small place.
My friend Dave Tull played there, and he said it's a really great place. And so I'm really happy that we're coming out there. I love to see, there's a club in Little Tokyo called Blue Whale. We played there on the 21st, so it was where we did our wide release party. And there are some new places that are coming up that are really exciting. I think you're right. I think we need more of those kind of places, places with the smaller capacity where it's very intimate with the band. And I've been to Japan several times. There are a number of places that are like little combination theater nightclub. It's a kind of place where you go in and it's theater seating, but in the lobby there's like a little, you know, place where you can get drinks and food, and then you go into the main room for the show. There's a lot of those kind of places in Japan, and I saw a few of them when I was over in Europe. And I'd love to see that kind of thing happen more here in the States. We used to have a place called the Jazz Bakery down in Culver City in Los Angeles. That was very similar to the places springing up all over the place in Japan and Europe. In fact, there's many more people over there that seem to consider jazz an art form worthy of spending money to hear. In the States, it's all like, what can you get for free?
Speaking with Jennifer Lightham, we're talking about her jazz career, also transitioning as a transgender woman, and she'll be at Squash Grapes on November 19th in Ventura to see her play with her trio.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it too. It's going to be great.